Chapter 12. Children Who Kill. The picture in the American newspaper shows a boy of about 11, his hands stuck in the pockets of his Levi's, his hair neatly brushed. He doesn't look in the least like a juvenile delinquent, but the caption says, Earl Weir of Pritchett, Colorado, stands solemnly before shelves of law books after relating that he shot his father, Leonard, with a .22 caliber hunting rifle while the father slept. I was mad at him for making me go to school, Earl told the sheriff. Sanity examinations are scheduled for the boy. Cases like this turn up in American newspapers with appalling frequency. Children who kill playmates in a burst of rage. Children who shoot parents to avenge some imagined wrong. Is there something wrong with the American educational system? Or are American kids simply more aggressive than their European counterparts? No, we have to face the fact that most children are capable of murder. Is there any adult who cannot recall having fantasies of revenge about some domineering schoolteacher, or at times hating his parents so much that he could kill them? It never lasts long, and in a normal, well-regulated society, the gap between fantasy and action is too wide for a child to bridge. But supposing a loaded gun was actually lying there, or supposing there was a bottle of poison within a few feet of the cup of coffee the offending adult was about to drink. Children are more spontaneous creatures than adults. When they're hurt, they cry. When they're angry, they hit out. When they want something, they grab it. And it is this spontaneity that can turn a child into a killer. Anybody who really wants to understand the mind of the murderer would do well to begin by studying children who kill. We now know that there is a special part of the brain that controls aggression. It's called the amygdala, or amygdaloid nucleus. This is a part of what we might call man's old brain. For, as strange as this sounds, man has three brains. Some 400 million years ago, the only life on Earth was to be found in the sea. And these creatures, man's earliest ancestors, possessed only a primitive brain, a part of which now forms the core of our brain. It contains the apparatus for breathing, digestion, sex, and aggression. When some of these fish-like creatures crawled ashore, some 300 million years ago, they began to develop another brain outside the animal brain. And when these early amphibians turned into reptiles, these early crocodiles and lizards had two brains. The new outer brain, or cortex, permitted learning and intelligent behaviour. Finally, as primitive ape-like creatures developed into man, a third brain came into being, the thinking brain. The truth seems to be that nature has made rather a mess of the evolution of the brain. Imagine a peasant who has lived in a small cottage, who one day makes enough money to build himself something bigger, and who builds a larger house around the old cottage. Then imagine still further that he's appointed ruler of the country and decides to build himself a palace, which he has built around the other two buildings. Well, this gives a rough idea of the structure of the human brain. Now, every human being starts as a kind of fish in his mother's womb and slowly develops into something like an early reptile, and then into an animal, and eventually into a human fetus. When we're born, we're regulated largely by the old brain. The third brain, the human brain, is hardly developed at all. Young children are little animals. They remain basically very close to the animal, as far as their instincts and impulses go, until puberty. Then, and only then, does the really human part of the brain begin to actively develop. There is another question that has to be considered before we can understand the child murderer, the question of dominance. We tend to regard aggression as being bad, but the truth is that a certain amount of aggression is essential both for society and for the individual. Think of Shakespeare, Milton, William Blake. All were, in their way, highly aggressive individuals. Some men of genius have actually been murderers, including Shakespeare's friend and fellow playwright Ben Jonson. Many a moody, impatient boy grows up to be an important writer. To some extent, dominance is based on a high energy output. Faced with a challenge, the dominant person becomes a dynamo of energy. Hormones rush into the bloodstream, and he becomes a kind of juggernaut. And what happens when a man possesses this dynamo but lacks the intelligence to make proper use of it? He becomes impatient, bad-tempered, a bully. He's liable to explosions of violence. The third brain, our specifically human brain, is not sufficiently developed to make use of this drive and willpower. This explains what happens in the case of many children who kill. Peter Curtin, the sadist of Dusseldorf, during whose reign of terror 8 people were murdered and innumerable others stabbed or battered, confessed that he committed his first 2 murders at the age of 9. He was playing on a raft on the banks of the River Rhine with 2 boys. He pushed one of them into the water. The boy could not swim and began to struggle. The other boy, who could swim, dived in to help him. Curtin managed to push him under the raft. Both were drowned. And since there were no witnesses, no one suspected Curtin. Curtin's later crimes were committed out of sadism. He experienced a sexual orgasm as he stabbed or throttled a victim. But the sadism was a later development. He himself said so to the psychiatrist who examined him, Professor Berg, and Curtin proved to be an exceptionally honest witness on the subject of his psychopathic urges. He almost certainly pushed the boy off the raft in a burst of sudden rage. Probably there was no intention of killing. Even when he thrust the other boy under the raft, he was still in the grip of his anger, and the aggression came easily. Berg's classic book, The Sadist, reveals that Curtin was a strange and complex man. He was intelligent and unusually honest. He told lies mainly to try to get witnesses into trouble, another manifestation of his sadism. He did not strike his workmates as violent. On the contrary, they found him a quiet man and a hard worker. They at first refused to believe that he could be the monster at all. His chief character defect was his vanity about his appearance. He always dressed with great care and would spend long periods carefully inspecting himself in the mirror. From Berg's book, we discover that Curtin's father was a typical violent man, in the sense described by the writer A.E. van Vugt. The examining magistrate described him as a man who scarcely knew any moral restraints, yet demanded for himself every sort of respect. Nor did he suffer contradiction or any challenge to his will. He was an alcoholic and also a stupid man. His son, Peter, inherited some of his dominance and drive, but was more intelligent. He was also, like his father, a sex maniac from an early age. He made his first attempt at rape at 16. It was the violent man in him that made him kill his 2 playmates at the age of 9. Of course, bad environment played an important part in creating the future killer. A dominant and intelligent child who has seen his father screaming with rage, smashing windows and raping his mother and eldest sister, a crime for which Curtin Sr. received 18 months in prison, is bound to develop a bitter and contemptuous attitude towards the world. When Curtin's own sexual drives became violent in his early teens, they combined with the dominance and aggression to turn him into a sadist. But the part played by environment is not necessarily vital in such cases. In many American instances of children who kill, like 11-year-old Earl Weir, the environment is as comfortable as a good income can make it. This can also be seen in a case that occurred in England in 1847, the poisoning of Samuel Nelm, deputy chairman of the Hackney Board of Guardians, by his grandson William Olnut, who was aged 12. William, a sickly child who was often in trouble with his teachers, had 7 brothers and sisters. 5 were away at boarding school, and at the time of the murder, 2 were staying with friends in the country, an indication that the household was fairly well off. Samuel Nelm was a dominant individual, and he was often impatient with his grandson, who was a dishonest child. Not long before the murder, he stole a watch and 10 sovereigns, fairly ambitious booty for such a young boy. On October the 20th, 1847, Grandfather Nelm lost his temper with William, gave him a violent blow that knocked him down, and banged his head against the wall. In a boiling rage, William waited until his grandfather had gone to the wine cellar. Then he took a packet of arsenic, used to poison rats, out of a drawer in the bureau, and poured this into a bowl of sugar on the dining room table, a bowl used mainly by old Mr. Nelm, who had a sweet tooth. The next day, the sugar bowl was refilled. William was clearly a vindictive child. He had had time to get over his rage, but he made no attempt to get rid of the arsenic. It stayed in the sugar bowl almost a week, and several members of the family were ill when they used it, including William's mother, who was a widow. William was apparently willing to poison the whole family in revenge. Finally, a week after the arsenic had been placed in the sugar bowl, Samuel Nelm died in agony. It was not until 9 days later, when the watch and the 10 sovereigns were found to be missing, that William was questioned and then arrested for theft. When an inquest revealed arsenic in Samuel Nelm's stomach, William confessed. It's a characteristic of most child criminals that they confess easily. A letter he sent to his mother admitting the crime sounds genuinely repentant. At his trial, it was revealed that his father had been a right man, given to violent fits of temper and also to epileptic attacks. He was also, like Curtin's father, an alcoholic. So, again, it would seem that the father's dominance and violence was passed on to the child. William's defence was insanity, but the jury rejected it. He was sentenced to death, then reprieved and sent to prison, where he apparently spent the remainder of his life. In those days, treatment of juvenile offenders was savage. This continued well into the 20th century. In 1924, 15-year-old Roland MacDonald of Amherst, Maine, was found guilty of the shotgun killing of a young schoolmistress, Louise Gerrish. He was still in prison 34 years later, and when a lie detector test suggested that he was not guilty of the murder, a request for parole was rejected. In the great majority of cases of murder of children by other children, the motive is usually some deep-seated resentment based upon jealousy. There are exceptions, but most of these could be classified almost as motiveless murder. These usually occur in slums. There was Alfred Dancy, a 14-year-old boy of Bedminster, Gloucestershire, who in 1850 was bullied by two older boys. He pulled out a loaded pistol and shot one of his persecutors dead. He was sentenced to 10 years' transportation. Then there was Alfred Fritz, aged 9, a slum boy from Liverpool, who lost his temper with a playmate, James Fleeson, and killed him with a half brick. He and another boy threw James into the canal. Found guilty of manslaughter in August of 1855, both were sentenced to 12 months in Liverpool prison. Perhaps the most famous, or infamous, of all juvenile killers was Jesse Pomeroy, who holds roughly the same place among children who kill as Jack the Ripper does amongst adult murderers. Pomeroy has become a figure of legend. If he had not been caught at the age of 14, he would undoubtedly have become the American equivalent of Peter Curtin. Pomeroy was a tall, gangling youth with a hare lip. One of his eyes was completely white. He was sadistic and almost certainly homosexual. In 1871 and 1872, Boston parents became anxious about an unknown youth who seemed to have an insane resentment of younger children. On December the 22nd, 1871, a boy named Payne was tied to a beam and beaten unconscious. This took place at Powderhorn Hill. The same thing happened again in February of 1872. A child named Tracy Hyden was enticed to the spot, stripped naked, beaten unconscious with a rope, and struck in the face so violently with a board that his nose was broken and several teeth knocked out. In July, a boy named Johnny Blach was taken to the same spot and beaten. Afterwards, his assailant moved him to a nearby creek and washed his wounds in salt water. In September, Robert Gould was tied to a telegraph pole near the Hartford and Erie Railroad track and was beaten and cut with a knife. Three more cases occurred in quick succession. In each, the boy was 7 or 8 years of age. All the victims were lured to a lonely place, stripped naked, beaten, and then stabbed or tortured with pins. Pomeroy's description was so unusual that it was not long before he was arrested on suspicion. His victims identified him. He was sentenced to a period in the Westboro Reform School. He was 12 years old at the time. 18 months later, in February of 1874, he was paroled and allowed to return home. His mother, according to one account, kept a grocery store. A month later, 10-year-old Mary Curran disappeared. 4 weeks after that, on April the 22nd, the mutilated body of a 4-year-old boy, Horace Mullen, was found near Dorchester, a Boston suburb. He had 31 knife wounds, and his head was almost completely severed from the body. Jesse Pomeroy immediately came under suspicion. A blood-stained knife was found in his room, and the mud on his shoes was similar to that of the marsh where the child had been found. Pomeroy soon confessed to the murder. Shortly afterwards, his mother had to move house, probably because of the scandal. The new tenant decided to enlarge the cellar. Labourers digging in the earth floor discovered the decomposed body of a young girl. Mary Curran's parents were able to identify their daughter from her clothes. Pomeroy also confessed to this murder. He was sentenced to be hanged on December the 10th, 1874, but was reprieved because of his youth. He was then 14. His sentence was commuted, somewhat inhumanely, to solitary confinement for life. Subsequently, he made several attempts to escape from prison. One of them suggests that he'd become suicidal. In 1883, he succeeded in puncturing a gas pipe, waited until he was almost overcome by the fumes, and then struck a match. The explosion blew out the door of his cell, but it also blew up Jesse Pomeroy. Three other convicts were burned to death. He was quickly moved to another jail, Charleston, and spent the next 41 years there. Towards the end of his life, he died at the age of 72, he was moved to the Bridgewater State Farm for the Criminally Insane, the prison from which the alleged Boston Strangler, Albert DeSalvo, later escaped. Pomeroy has become a legend of horror. One highly unreliable account credits him with 27 murders, giving circumstantial and totally untrue details. On the other hand, none of the accounts states whether Pomeroy sexually assaulted his victims and whether Mary Curran was raped. In spite of this, it seems clear that Pomeroy's motives were sexual. There's no fundamental difference between the youthful killer and the homicidal adult. In the young criminal, impulses are translated directly into action, as they are in such mentally defective killers as Straffan, the child strangler. The youngster may be suffering from an hereditary taint, or may simply be violent and sullen by nature. In 1886, a 12-year-old girl named Marie Schneider was tried in Berlin. She had taken a 3-year-old girl to a second-story window, sat her on the windowsill, and deliberately pushed her out after stealing the child's earrings. She intended to sell the earrings to buy sweets. She was known as a sadistic and dishonest child who never lost an opportunity to bully and torture younger children. She was sent to prison for 8 years. A 10-year-old boy named William York appears to be another example of hereditary taint. He lived in the workhouse at the village of Eek, near Bury St Edmunds in England, and shared a bed with a 5-year-old girl, Susan Mayhew. One morning, when Susan had fouled the bed, William York took her into the yard and methodically cut her wrist down to the bone, all the way round. He did the same thing to the elbow and her other arm, and then slashed her thigh open. In 1748 he was sentenced to death, but was finally reprieved on condition that he joined the Navy, where presumably he would be brutalised by ill-treatment and sexual attacks. In modern times, there's an increasing tendency for the young offender to be an outsider figure, alienated from his family and background. Graham Young, the English mass poisoner sentenced to life imprisonment in 1972, is typical of this new phenomenon. His father, a machine setter, was a widower, and he married again when Graham was 3. The family lived in Neasden in North London. Graham was an odd boy, fascinated by chemistry and by poisons, and, like Moore's murderer Ian Brady, an admirer of Hitler. He felt an intense dislike of the commonplace. His sister, Winifred, tells a typical anecdote. On a bus with their cousin, Sandra, they saw a friend, and Sandra remarked, "That's Jacqueline's boyfriend, Jim." Young repeated mockingly, "Oh, is that Jacqueline's boyfriend, Jim?" and kept repeating variations on the sentence all the way home. Obviously, the ordinariness of it made him unhinged and verbally sadistic. He began trying out various poisons on his family when he was 13. His sister, Winifred, tasted a cup of tea one morning and threw it away. It had a bitter flavour. On the way to work, she felt things advancing and receding. Her employer sent her to hospital, where she was told she was suffering from belladonna poisoning. Her pupils were enormously enlarged. Taxed with this, Graham explained that he had put it in her tea by mistake. The rest of the family continued to have bouts of sickness. So did a school friend. During Easter of 1962, his stepmother, Molly, died and was cremated. Then his father became seriously ill. Hospital tests showed he was suffering from arsenic and antimony poisoning. There had been friction between Graham and his father. Every time his father admonished him, Graham gave him a dose of poison. Sentenced to Broadmoor, Young was released after 9 years. He immediately found a job at John Hadland's Photographic Limited at Bovingdon in Hertfordshire. And the man who referred to himself as your friendly neighbourhood Frankenstein immediately went back to his favourite hobby of poisoning. Before he was arrested in November 1971, 2 workmates had died of thallium poisoning, and 2 more became seriously ill. Young may have started administering poison out of curiosity and resentment. Unfortunately, it then became a habit. Children are more malleable than adults, and therefore more easily treated. The problem of the juvenile criminal, the young murderer, is still a long way from a solution, but recent advances in psychiatry make the prospects of an answer more hopeful than they have ever been before. As the child is father to the man, so he can also be the sire to the killer. It's up to the parents and adults in society to watch for this immature monster, to spot him before he has time to fully develop, and to see that he gets the correct and humane treatment necessary to make his or her life happy, and to make the lives of others safe.